I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Kimberly Smith, the global head of corporate at the law firm Catton. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David. Happy to be here.
We're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First of all, your background and what you're seeing in M&A right now. Then the challenges of law firm management at the moment, given the intense demand for lawyers and the retention challenges that creates. And finally, a little bit about how you have stayed sane in our now almost 2 years of COVID. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to practice law and corporate law.
Sure. So I'm based in Chicago, but Catton has offices throughout the U.S. as well as in London and Shanghai. And, you know, growing up was always predisposed, I suppose, to being interested in the law. I loved reading. I loved politics and policy and found that fascinating. So there wasn't much discretion in terms of considering other career paths. I was always very focused on that direction. I think the route to get into private equity and M&A was probably a little bit less straight. I started thinking I would be a trial lawyer and frankly, very enamored with trial lawyers and what they did. When I was in college, I was fortunate enough to intern at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C. for a semester where I worked full-time in the violent crimes unit and was able to work very closely with the AUSAs there as they prepared for trial, including witness prep, dealing with the DC police and the FBI, who took me on ride-alongs and to the training facilities at Quantico and just really got me excited about the notion of being a trial lawyer. But then as I was a summer associate in big law, I realized that litigation at a large law firm is not quite what you would expect if you wanted to spend all of your time in court. And probably more importantly, that I was just better aligned with the approach of a transactional lawyer and the practical side of me that enjoys bringing parties together and making deals was very enamored with M&A work once I realized that it existed and what it entailed and that it was a path available to me in big law. So coming out of law school, I joined the Catton corporate department and have been there working on M&A transactions ever since.
And tell us a little bit about how your practice has evolved in that time.
Sure. So coming out of law school, I was working on both M&A transactions as well as in the capital markets area. But that quickly became more skewed towards capital markets, given the sheer volume of what was happening in the industry at that time. It was the ramp up of the dot-com bubble. And so there was a significant amount of public offering work where we were handling IPOs and follow-on offerings. As a very young attorney, I was flying all over the country for drafting sessions and working around the clock on all of the internet businesses trying to go public and raise money. And so that really was a focus early in my career because that's where the work was. Once the bubble burst and that pipeline dried up, we all shifted back to being full-time M&A lawyers. And I found that more aligned for me and my interests and my personality. I love that on the M&A side, you can really dig into the business, understand your clients' investment goals, and help work with them to really focus on what's important to them and try to make that happen while protecting their risks and their investment. And so even when the capital markets work came back, I stayed on the M&A side where I remain today.
And tell us a little bit about your client mix and what you're seeing in the market now.
Sure. So I work primarily in the middle market, representing private equity funds on their platform acquisitions, add-on transactions, and then ultimate divestitures or liquidation of their investments. While many of my clients are middle market private equity funds, I also represent some family offices doing direct deals. So for example, I work with Equity Group Investments, which is Sam Zell's family office. I work with PSP Capital, which was founded and is chaired by Penny Pritzker, former U.S. Commerce Secretary. We actually just closed a deal for PSP that they announced, which was the partnership with Intiva, which will help to expand their digital transformation investment thesis in a way that's really exciting for them. And, you know, also on the family office front, even when we're not representing a family office, they often come into play in our transactions. So, for example, late last year, we represented West Monroe Partners on their investment by MSD, which is Michael Dell's family office. He took a meaningful stake in that company. And so we were very involved in that deal as well. So family offices, you know, as they've begun to do more and more direct investing in larger deals, has been a big pipeline for us as well.
A couple of things. First of all, could you contrast working with family offices as opposed to private equity firms?
In many ways, the exercise for us is exactly the same. And it really needs to be, particularly when a family office is competing with a private equity investor in an auction situation to try to win the deal. We, in both cases, we need to make our client look like the most attractive investor who should win the deal. I think where there are differences include the long-term play for the investor. So the family office may not have the same IRR pressure that a private equity fund would have, and therefore can talk about being more patient capital and having more discretion to execute the next liquidity event when it really makes sense for the business versus that on some more predisposed timeline. But I think the flip side to that is if you're trying to woo a management team talking about their next bite at the apple or liquidity event, sometimes when you are trying to have that dialogue as a family office, there's some pressure on that because they may not see that you will turn that asset as quickly as a fund. And so you may need to get creative to come up with some puts or other ways for the management team to get liquidity.
And so how do you end up doing that? Do you just go with options, phantom equity? What are some of the techniques you use to bridge that gap?
That's exactly right. So it's thinking of creative ways to make management's equity, whether it's their rollover equity that they're rolling in the deal and or incentive equity being issued to them as part of the new transaction, we want to make that attractive and the management team to know that they'll be able to monetize that value. So it's exactly what you suggested. It sometimes we use phantom equity or give them a put or have other predefined liquidity targets on the horizon. But really, at the end of the day, the goal is very similar to what you would see with a private equity fund, which is working to align incentives and to make sure that everyone benefits from the future growth and that everyone's working towards that goal.
Obviously, last year, there was an extraordinary amount of deal activity in private equity at all levels. What are you seeing in the middle market now in terms of trends?
So the volume continues to be astronomical. Auction processes remain extremely competitive, which just continues to drive valuations up. So we do see situations where investors are making very hard runs at businesses, spending a lot of money on deal expenses to get themselves in a position to close quickly, only to lose the auction because they just couldn't get to the winning position on value. And so for some investors, after you go through that a couple of times, you realize that it can be painful for many reasons. And so you might start to look for other ways to get deals done. And because of that, we're seeing some creative approaches, such as an increasing interest in carve-outs. Carve-outs can be complicated and probably weren't always for everyone, but when you, it might be your only path to getting a deal done, you know, suddenly it may not look so bad, and those risks and that complexity can be managed. We're also seeing investors combining smaller deals into an initial platform. So maybe instead of going out and buying one target for an enterprise value of $500 million, if that was the sweet spot, investors are going and finding two or even three companies to bring together on day one to get to that level. So we're seeing some creativity in that regard as well. You know, another way is that some sponsors are starting to take minority positions where they probably wouldn't have done that in the past. The idea being that it gets their foot in the door and maybe something that they can use to grow their stake over time.
And then you're also seeing, even in the middle market, increased regulatory activity. How is that affecting deal making as well?
So in the US, as well as in the UK and in Europe, we're seeing an increasing aggressiveness and unpredictability of antitrust and foreign investment authorities. And so what that means is that in many cases, it's taking longer to get deals closed. And based on the public statements being made by these regulators and what we're seeing as deals try to work their way through the systems, is that this challenge is here to stay. And it's something that deal professionals are going to have to figure out how to sort out. And I think it will have a pretty large impact on deal making overall in a couple of ways. First, you know, in these deals where it's clear that they just won't sail through the regulatory process, the parties are going to need to focus more than ever on the interim covenants, because they will become more important as the time between signing and closing just continues to extend. I think also there will be more pressure on failed closing conditions, as in some cases they become a reality. And so in light of that, buyers and sellers are getting more proactive to solve any expected issues. So for example, if you had parties that had signed up a deal and they knew that there might be one particular market where the antitrust regulators could have some issues or some difficulty, perhaps instead of waiting for the FTC to raise that issue, the buyer and seller are now going in from the very beginning with a plan to solve that issue and liquidate the assets in that market. So I think we'll see people working more proactively to get around those challenges, but overall, it will increase the complexity of getting deals done and the time that it takes to do so.
So in a sense, that even in the middle market in private equity, you have a process with regard to antitrust that will end up looking more like a larger ticket strategic combination in terms of managing regulatory risk.
That's right. Or maybe another way to say it is that I think more middle market deals will get swept up in that process than ever before. Because where you have a financial investor with no competitive overlap, the regulators have, under the new administration, have said, we are skeptical of private equity roll-ups, and we are going to be digging into them more than our predecessors. And so it is a shifting regulatory landscape.
And what pressures has the deal activity in private equity put on law firms in terms of retaining lawyers, and how are you trying to manage those?
So there was a marked increase in demand for legal services in 2021. Really, all areas were up, but the largest growth was driven by corporate M&A and real estate, which makes perfect sense when you look at where the greatest activity was. You know, and because of that, hiring levels grew in a way really not seen in the past 10 years. People were asked to work hard to dig deep, particularly in the fourth quarter of 2021, to get the deals done that needed to be completed by year end. And I think implicit in that directive to team members to just hang in there and get through the end of the year was the suggestion that once we did that, we would get a break, that the activity would ease. And that just hasn't happened. We've had deals that should have been closed in 2021 that for a variety of reasons extended into 2022, and we're still working very actively on those deals. New deals continue to come in the door every day. So there really hasn't been any sort of let up, and we are very focused on making sure that people don't burn out. And so retention is very much a concern, as well as recruiting. We're continuing to look to build and grow as we move forward and see no sign of the demand easing anytime soon.
So how do you go about retaining, especially associates, in a market where there's such enormous demand for them? I mean, beyond obviously paying them more, but of course, everybody can pay them more.
Well, you're right. Everyone can pay more and everyone is paying more. We've seen a number of associate compensation hikes in the past year, and our firm has met those. And it doesn't seem that firms deciding to throw money at the problem is going to be the solution. I think matching compensation increases are merely table stakes that keep you in the game. And then the question becomes, what else do people want? And how do we keep people engaged and having good job satisfaction with us? And so what we're focused on in that regard and what people tell us that they want to see is flexibility. They want control over their working arrangements. They want to feel like what they're doing has meaning and purpose. They want to see more emphasis on work-life balance issues and mental well-being. So we're working hard to be responsive to that and developing programs and policies that speak to retention. So for example, we've got a program called Catalyst, spelled of course with the cat and K-A-T-T, that pairs diverse attorneys as proteges with senior level partners as their sponsors to provide training and coaching opportunities to enhance leadership and business development skills and to coach folks through the system. We are very focused on wellness, offering programs such as sessions on how to reduce and manage stress and anxiety, and just continually work to respond to what we're hearing are on people's minds and to work to address those topics in a meaningful way.
You mentioned at the outset of the podcast that you did a lot of capital markets work during the internet boom in the late 90s when there was similar pressure on law firms. Obviously, in the private equity bull market of 2005 to 2007, there were also these retention pressures on law firms. How would you compare the pressures you're seeing now in this area to those earlier periods in law firm management?
I think the pressures are greater now. I think the demand has been more intense and sustained for much longer. I mean, look, we're basically into almost 2 years now of the so-called COVID rebound, you know, certainly a year and a half where we've seen the activity coming back and just continuing to grow and grow and grow, which is great for our practice, but really puts a lot of pressure on the deep bench that we have. So I do think it's different in that it's more prolonged, it's more intense, and we're having to work harder than ever to address it and to keep people engaged and retained.
And that raises the question of what you think the practice may look like in 3 to 5 years, because obviously it's not just associates who feel this pressure, it's partners at every level. And in some ways, the mid-level associate has a lot more flexibility in terms of career options than the mid-level partner does.
That's interesting. I think you could argue that both ways. But in terms of where I see things going and what it will look like in 3 to 5 years, I think there are some fundamental components of what we do that will be constant. For example, to effectively run an M&A transaction, you need a team, and that team is comprised of people who bring to the table various specialties and skills and expertise that you need to provide top-tier service to your client and make sure that you're covering all bases. The way that that team works together, to me, seems to be something that we've figured out how to execute in a very successful way. I think what will change is how we work together, meaning is it fully remote, fully in person? We've clearly proven that people are capable of working from home and have been doing that now for almost 2 years. So that's really not the issue. I think the question is, are we missing something in terms of being connected with each other that is not a sustainable model? And that question will, I think, drive us back to the office as soon as we're able to do it in a safe way, but likely it will never be what it was pre-COVID, where you have people spending that much time in the office. People want flexibility and control over their schedules. So I think we will evolve to a model where people are very much working remotely, but coming together at designated times to make sure that we're connected as a group.
And then how, over the last year and a half or 2 years, have you kept your own sense of balance and sanity given work from home, you know, and just the extraordinary workload you've seen?
It's been intense because at first, when the shutdown occurred in 2020, while the deals that we were working on either died or went on hold, there were many, many other questions from our clients and concerns and risks that needed to be addressed. And so it wasn't that we stopped being busy. It was just that the nature of what we were doing changed. And then add on top of that, all of the issues for the law firm in dealing with the rapidly changing scenario of the pandemic from a management or leadership perspective. It was intense and very, very busy. Before that happened, I guess I would have called myself a runner. I enjoyed running. I had done a Spartan race with a client who asked me to be on their team a few years earlier. And as part of my training for that, shifted from a person who absolutely detested running to someone who enjoyed it. And so that really was my lifeline when the shutdown first occurred. I went from going out a couple times a week to getting out every day and running longer. And it really was a great mental and emotional and physical escape for me that I think was tremendously helpful.
Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.